friends, it is Saturday, April 25th, 2015. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, broadcasting from the cold, rainy Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today on RBN, whose website is republicbroadcasting.org. I also invite you to visit my website, spingola.com, for links for today's program. Simply click on the radio schedule button on the left. I also invite you to visit my other website, screeningsandyhook.com, for information about my new book, Screening Sandy Hook Causes and Consequences, which is now available as a paperback, hardback, or as a Kindle from Amazon. And of course, you can purchase the paperback and the hardback from me via my website. I also invite you to visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, a site that one of our listeners created. He maintains that site. If you wish to post comments about the program, then you may do so at this site. He also has a lot of other interesting links. Alrighty. During the program, email any questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the third hour at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlstrom. He is the author, well, his latest book is, it's a fabulous book. It is entitled Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. I finished the book this morning, and I went through the entire book, all the appendixes, and it was the epilogue, everything. I didn't read the index, but I read everything from the front cover forward, and it's just a fabulous, fabulous book, and I do hope that people will purchase that book. We are having a little bit of an issue attempting to get a hold of him. He does need to... He's set? Oh, perfect. Wonderful. Welcome to the program.
Can you hear me, Diana?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much.
Oh, great. There's a bit of an echo on my line. That's the only trouble.
Okay. Are you using a headset or...
Yeah. No, it's better now. It's fine.
Oh, okay, great. Wonderful. You were on with me, gosh, it's been a couple of years, and of course I've kept up with what you're doing, and hopefully you heard my introduction wherein I talked about your book, which I finish this morning. As soon as we made contact last week, I bought the book via, I love Kindle books, and it's just such a comprehensive book. I just really appreciate it. And I took a lot of notes, and so I really appreciate the way that you've put the book together. Let's see. Your website, whatreallyhappened.info. We need to let people know about that.
Yeah, that is the British revisionist website, and me and some friends put it together, and we've got a whole lot of basic primary source data from British intelligence decrypts on that website, so anyone can check it. The stuff I refer to in my book, you know, the data is there on that website.
Indeed, exactly. Would you venture to say that if the people, the general public, had access to all of the records that you mentioned in your book, if they had the records of, there's like four different kinds of primary sources. The records that were kept during the war, which you indicate are primary source data, if they had access to the International Committee of the Red Cross, those records, and if they had access to the death books and to the Bad Errolson records and to the British intelligence decrypts, and if they hadn't listened to the media, would they believe that there had been a Holocaust, if they had records, if they had access to those official records.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thank you for mentioning the absolute main primary source records for how many people lived and how many people died in the German labour camps. I think it's so good that we've just gone through, you mentioned about four of them, and these are unimpeachable sources, you know. They're from places collected during the war or just after the war, and there's no question they are authoritative. And as you say, they basically negate the concept of the Holocaust. They show, I mean, Jews had obviously had a terrible time in World War II, and obviously they were thrown out of their native country, Germany, and made to move eastwards. But what these figures show is not an intention to exterminate them. The intention to exterminate is kind of made up, and it's become the stuff of Hollywood movies. But what these figures show, for example, is that the proportion of Jews in the camps that were dying was not really any different from the proportion of Jews who were living in the camps. There's maybe around about 40% or a bit less of all the people living in the German labour camps who were Jewish, and that is more or less the proportion that die over the couple of years for which we have the data, Diana. We've got the basic data, 42 and 43. That is where it extends for. And it shows the, obviously during the horror of war, a lot of people died. And in the camps, the concentrated populations meant that catastrophe did strike the camps as the terrible diseases of typhus and typhoid ravaged the camps. And I think this data shows the Germans doing their best to bring this terrible epidemic under control. And then there are some later figures, to which you also alluded, towards the end of the war, that show with the terrific intensity of British-American carpet bombing of Central Europe with 2 million tons of bombs, the complete destruction of infrastructure. Camps did not have food, and some of them, like Bergen-Belsen, didn't even have water. And with some of the camps, you get, especially in Germany, you get a terrific peak, dreadful peak in mortality at the end of 44 and 45. And again, figures tell a story here, that they show the awful catastrophe as the labour camps turned into death camps. I believe that's what they show us. If, as you say, the general public had access to these data, if students were allowed to study them, Diana, which they're not in my country, I don't know about America, then I think we would start having a sensible view of what happened in the labour camps, and the great religion of the Holocaust would fade away.
Right. And of course, I believe that that Britain and America and of course the Russians all concealed this data in order to, well, during the Cold War. I think that the Cold War served the purpose of concealing the records.
Yeah.
Of building up Israel militarily. And of creating this Holocaust myth. And you also indicate in the book, in the death books, that the Soviets seized at Auschwitz when they liberated, quote unquote, Auschwitz, that the records show that there were some death certificates for about 70,000 people, most of them, that there were more deaths, more Catholic deaths at Auschwitz than there were Jewish deaths.
Correct. Yeah, that's what they show. Yeah, yeah. And say we go down to the number of Jewish deaths, say about 29,000. There are some death books missing. Okay, and there are certainly unregistered people who did not have the deaths recorded. Okay, and I would say you can push up that total at around about 40,000 Jews dying in Auschwitz. I frankly don't think it's going to go any higher. And I do really, really wish that intelligent American students were allowed to study this data and judge these things, you know, instead of being given these hallucinatory figures, enormously large figures from totally unreliable sources. These sources we're talking about, the death books, the Allison archive totals, from the International Red Cross. These are basic sources, and they give us real numbers. And as you say, these totals are not outrageously large. They're nothing like the figures that were given in the news and in the in the movies.
Right. And do you think that possibly the Cold War and, well, we have several decades of, between 4 and 5 decades of, Hollywood movies and the idea that this Cold War, that all of a sudden, the Soviets and the Americans, are enemies, and meanwhile, the Israeli state is being built up. Do you think that this farce of a Cold War allowed the myth to take hold and to be deeply embedded into the worldwide population? Do you think that the Cold War served to do that?
Well, yeah. Let me say, first of all, Diana, the wonderful books I'm just looking at on your website show, I think, you've got obviously a very profound grasp of these matters. As a science historian, my approach is very much looking at the basic facts and the basic data whereby we can infer what happens. What I personally noticed was that as long as we had the nuclear holocaust, that was the big fear everybody had, and that lasted up until round about 1990, and suddenly, the communist menace was gone, and the haunting intensity of the holocaust, which it has today, that has grown and grown ever since the nuclear holocaust vanished, okay? I'll just note, the nuclear holocaust is a correct use of the term. The term does mean a fiery event. It absolutely cannot refer to death by gassing, even mass death by gassing. That is not properly called a holocaust at all, okay? That's a fiery process, and there was the big fear hanging over us all of the nuclear holocaust. Now, the terrific intensity, it's as if that it's a spiritual cultural weakness of the American and British people. They do always need to be given an enemy. They don't have the capacity to fulfill their lives and live together without having an enemy to hate and fear. To be governed, you have this awful trick of manufacturing an enemy, drumming up an enemy, and once the communists could no longer be an enemy, then the old Nazis, even 70 years ago, can be drummed up as the enemy, and we get it every week in the papers now, Holocaust. And someone said to me, why is it people hate the Nazis more than they hate anyone else, far more than the communists or more than Muslims? It's as if the war just ended yesterday, not 70 years ago. We're given that intense hatred. Obviously, Nazi Zion, they're almost the same word, almost the same letters, very, very similar ideologies. The having the enemy as the Nazi has the terrific implication for those in power that the Jews become the good guys. They become the embodiments of God's chosen people, because of the wicked Nazis who are wanting to exterminate 6 million Jews for no discernible reason, except that the Nazis were bad, then it follows that the Jews must be the good guys. That's the dualistic metaphysic of this new Holocaustian religion that the world is being given today. It basically incites race hate against Germany, okay? Holocaust belief is race hate, and it's race hate against Germany, and we've got to put a stop to it.
Indeed. One of our listeners, what you just said brought up the idea that is expressed in this email. And he says, the word Holocaust used to mean death on a large scale, especially by fire. But when the word became capitalized, its meaning was changed, such that non-Jews can no longer be considered victims. Here's the Jewish version. When we burn the dinner and the whole thing goes up in smoke, do we call it a Holocaust? No. Why not? Because it has nothing to do with Jewish suffering. When Dresden was bombed and the whole city went up in smoke, did we call it a Holocaust? No. Why not? For the same reason. So I thank my listener for bringing that to our attention.
Yeah. I'd like to suggest, if you can, avoid too much focus on Jews when you're talking about what happened in the German labour camps. That's what my book is about, what really happened. We're not denying anything, we're not deniers, we're simply giving a historical account of what happened. And in the German labour camps, the administrators kept four different columns, types of people. There were Poles, Russians, Jews and German political prisoners. And let's not talk as if the Jews were the only people there, okay?
Exactly.
In British intelligence decrypts, I may say, for a whole year they were getting these decrypts, overhearing what was happening in all the German labour camps because they cracked the German codes. And Jews are always referred to in a perfectly respectful manner. The Jews' ability to do all sorts of... They're trying to get useful industrial work out of the different inmates, this multicultural environment. And Jews are always referred to in a perfectly respectful manner. There's no hint of any Holocaust going on in the British intelligence decrypts. And people are sent out of the labour camps as well as coming in. It's not just you come in, oh, that's the end. People are sent out from Auschwitz. Thousands of people leave just as they come. And people are shuffled around the labour camps in this business of trying to get useful work out of the people.
Okay? Right.
But having said that, we can't avoid facing the fact that Jews are trying to take control of it. And if they're trying to take control of it, I suggest bringing up the fact that Jews who have claimed reparations from Germany after the war on the grounds of being Holocaust survivors are now up to about 6 million. Okay. And Germany has coughed up well over 100 billion Deutschmarks in this business of paying reparations. So the total number of Jews who have applied for reparations, not all of them got it, is far greater than the total number of Jews who ever lived in areas of Europe under the control of the Nazis, okay? You've got about 3 million, some people say 4 million, my book estimates 3 million around about of Jews in the lands that came to be controlled by Germany in the war, okay? So roughly, very roughly, double that have held out their hand for compensation. And as Horison points out, this they've absolutely negated their own story by doing this. The sheer number of Jews have held out their hand for reparations from Germany have basically nullified their own story.
Indeed, indeed. Now, these decrypts talk about what daily life in the camps, and there was no evidence of any final solution. None.
Well, what the final solution meant, Diana, Endlösung der Judenfrage, right, the Germany, that's the German, it meant the goal or end solution of the Jewish question. It didn't really mean final, and the goal solution was always territorial. I could have, in these decrypts, you don't hear that phrase, okay? But the decrypts were released in the mid-90s. They were kept secret for 50 years. And since they've been released, I think it's fair to say that virtually no British historians have been interested in them.
Right.
Because they're not sure of the Holocaust.
Doctor, I'm sorry, we are going to a real quick break. We will be right back in 3 minutes. Sorry to cut you off there. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom. He is the author of this fabulous book, Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. His website, the one that he is associated with, is whatreallyhappened.info. And you brought up the point of Holocaustianity in your book. You kind of made a comparison between Holocaustianity and Christianity, and how the Holocaustianity has really switched positions. And I really like what you said about that and how you compared it.
That's my experience, Dana. There's terrific, profound emotions. So it's a bit of an echo in this. In the Holocaustian religion, as compared, there's an awful echo up here. Are you hearing this?
Yes, you sound fine.
All right.
I'm hearing an echo.
Okay, let me just see what Mr. Producer, we have an echo. Is there do you have anything on in the background, Doctor?
No.
Okay. And you've got your headset on. I have my headset on.
Yeah.
How does it sound now?
Talk through it if I can. Let's just continue then. I think that the Holocaustian religion, that's better now, has pushed out the old religions, and it's more contemporary. It feeds people's nihilism and despair, as if that's what they need, and it gives them this terrific river of guilt. Oh, God, what we did to God's chosen people. As if that is some sort of nourishment, even in a very negative soul condition. And the old religions had some vision of glory that you could look forward to, whereas the Holocaustian religion has this vision of ghastly horror, of meaningless mass death for no reason, that everyone collectively has to believe in to be a good citizen. So it is a slave religion, okay? It's a slave religion, and a society that believes in it, the future will get worse for that society. Golgotha has been displaced now by Auschwitz, you get that any politician now can access deep emotions of the people by using the key words, you know, Hitler, Auschwitz, Jew, Holocaust, it functions just like a religion. And what I found, I published some scientific essays in 2006. I was in a history of science department at University College London, and I suddenly got thrown out. I was analysing the chemical residues, or looking at a couple of surveys people had done of how wherever cyanide was used in the labour camps of World War II, it soaked right into the walls, and all you had to do was chip away at the walls and measure the cyanide, because it bonded with the iron in the walls to measure iron cyanide. And I liked that simple, straightforward argument, but it was still there 60 years later because of that firm iron cyanide bond. Okay, my mum was a school chemistry teacher, and so I put out these scientific studies, okay, two or three essays up on the web. And when I got suddenly thrown out of my college and ethically damned by newspapers and blogs, what puzzled me was that nobody wanted to discuss what I said in these blogs. Instead, everyone was saying, oh, Nazi, Nazi, oh, we found a Nazi, and oh, how wicked, and oh, how dreadful, all these years I knew this guy, I never realised he was a Nazi, and so on. I realised that there was not going to be any discussion. The only way I could get discussion of this issue, which I still think is a very fascinating one, was to go onto a revisionist website, okay, which I then started doing. And that's how I gradually got a focus on this subject. And I had to apprehend that what I had thought or hoped could be a scientific discussion was totally overshadowed by a deep religious fervour, terrific fervour. Suddenly, this was far more important than anything else. You know, something had happened 70 years ago and 1,000 miles away in Poland was far more important than any 21st century issue. I had to try and figure out, why is this so? And I think it is a religious type thing that's happened. I mean, people believe in the Holocaust a bit like they believe in the Exodus, you know. They're both grandiose stories which probably didn't happen, and brewed up by the same people. I think we need to try and hold on to belief in scientific rationality, whereby you started off by talking about, you know, basic statistical surveys that showed how many people lived and died in the German labour camps, Diana. Well, I think that's what we need to do. We need some real arithmetic, not stuff brewed up. Right through the 20th century, we had this incantation of 6 million Jews. That's what it is. It's an incantation to numb thought, right? It started off at the end of the 19th century, and it kept being repeated all through the beginning of the 20th century. 6 million Jews started off in Russia. 6 million Jews were in danger, you know, then in Europe. And it was an American fundraising ploy, okay, especially during the First World War, to get funding for Jews by the 6 million Jews in Europe that were in danger. And then it ended up 6 million Jews in Nazi Germany. And then suddenly at Nuremberg, 6 million Jews had been gassed, or most of them had been gassed.
Right. Okay, we are going to a 3-minute. We will be right back, and we'll pick this up on the other side. Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom. He is the author of a wonderful book called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. And he is associated with the website whatreallyhappened.info. And what provoked your interest in 2007? Now, I know that you're a scientist, a historian. What provoked your interest in this particular subject?
Well, Diana, as a science historian, I decided to major in the subject because I feel that controversial aspects in the development of science need to be critiqued and investigated, okay? And the thing I looked at, which is how delousing technology works in World War II, may seem a rather boring subject, I think that's exactly what science historians should be doing, okay? And the whole Holocaust mythology has come about because of failure of science historians, that they have not done this. You can't read anything by science historians about how that delousing technology works, and that is because at Nuremberg, the hallucination, whatever you want to call it, was perpetrated, whereby the Zyklon was, the actual normal use of it was forgotten, that it was actually used to kill bugs, not Jews, and had clothes put into the delousing chambers, not people. That was forgotten, and the hallucinatory idea of a room stacked full of people, all Jews, completely, nearly all, forget about the other people, and you shower this stuff in through holes in the ceiling, which clearly didn't exist anywhere in any authentic historical building. That is a hallucination, and science historians ought to be doing their job. That's exactly why the subject exists, to critique science when it goes wrong. I feel that is what has happened. I think there is academic timidity here of not looking at how, it was a normal technology for about 40 years, beginning of the century up to about 45, how Zyklon was used, after that it was replaced by DDT, that's used after the war for killing bugs. That's what all your listeners will have heard about. There are very simple scientific aspects to this problem. If people had been gassed with cyanide, they would end up a bright pink colour. You'd have piles of bright pink, shocking bright pink bodies, and not a single one of those was ever reported in any German labour camp. Okay, this that should show you, and also the walls go blue. If you're really using Zyklon in a big human gas chamber, you'd end up with blue walls because of the iron cyanide is blue, and you don't get that. You get the blue walls in the little remains of the delousing chambers, which are written out of the history books until the revisionists started going there. So there's very simple, straightforward science here, I majored in the history of science just because I believe that's the sort of thing you should be looking at. Maybe I'm a bit iconoclastic, you know, anti-establishment character, whatever, but I just started looking at this.
Okay, and you're talking about too the two scientific investigations, one done by Fred Leuchter, and then a couple of years later, Germar Rudolph, who is a chemist, went over, and you've kind of combined those two, and they both show the exact same thing, and then you also talked about Nuremberg and the reason why. They could produce this figure, and the reason. Well, you also mentioned. There's so many things in your book to bring out that it was a military tribunal, which means that the defense could not present any evidence because it was a military tribunal.
No, that's the point of the military. Justice had nothing to do with it. It was a procedure for lynching, for making up retroactive laws, and then judging the defeated Germans as guilty, and lynching them, and extracting the confessions under torture. That was the most horrific thing, which a lot of citizens don't know about, the torture of Germans to get them to try and confess to the gas chamber story. And obviously Rudolf Höss, the commander of Auschwitz, was the great success there. That was the great triumph of the Nuremberg trial. After torturing him for 3 days and three nights, he eventually came out with his story of how he gassed 2 million Jews. He signed it. It was written out for him to sign, and he signed it. So that was actually a complete travesty of justice at Nuremberg. It's as if the purpose of the war wasn't just to defeat Germany physically, but to destroy it morally and spiritually.
Right. And the story about his torture, the information about this torture, did not become known until 1983, nearly 40 years later.
Yeah, that is so important, Dan. I'm glad you mentioned that. For all those years, people thought it was a real confession. You know, they believed it. And it wasn't until a book came out about this British Army hit team that got hold of Höss and tortured him and told the story. And the great master of modern revision, a chap called Forison, realised what was going on. And he basically told the story. And that's how revisionists came to understand what
indeed
had really happened. Yeah.
And a group of people beat him quite badly in 1989. So I think the revisionists have really suffered greatly. I mean, you lost your position in 2008 at the university after teaching there for 15 years. All of a sudden, you were done.
Yeah, well, Forison, yeah, he has suffered badly. Let's remember his great definition of what revisionism is. He said, it's a quest for historical exactitude. Now,
right,
that is what it's all about. It's not a political program. They're always trying to make out you're involved in some political agenda, you know, that you've got some right-wing political agenda. Well, no, we haven't, actually. We're just angry at being lied to, and we want the truth, you know.
Right. Now, do you think that that the propaganda was just so intense, and the testimonies that were given through the Shoah Foundation and elsewhere, and the Hollywood movies? Do you think that all of this was so strong? Obviously, it was very, very effective and very influential.
Yeah.
But it certainly, all of this was proposed, all of this was presented with absolutely no scientific evidence whatsoever. And when you think about it,
they couldn't produce a single gas body at Nuremberg, you know. They couldn't produce any documents. No document showing an intention to exterminate Jews. No document showing the construction of a human gas chamber. No documents recording the process happening. No photographs. They've got a huge amount of Nazi records and stuff, but they can't find any trace of a Holocaust going on. I mean, when the British intelligence secrets came out, they're finally released. British historians apologising. Oh no, it's so awful because we failed to realise the Holocaust was going on in the decrypts. Well, no, it just wasn't happening, you know. And so we've got still today, as if people are hypnotised. Why are historians not books being published on the Holocaust which don't allude to the British intelligence decrypts? Why do they just miss them out? Because they're the most authoritative, authentic possible source, and they don't show any Holocaust going on. It's as if people are somehow, as you say, hypnotized by the immensity of the propaganda. I mean, we had one historian in Britain who I think will be remembered, history will be remembered. He did really try to get authentic data, and that's Irving, David Irving. And he got so heavily vilified and broken that, you know, I think he's rather emotionally damaged. But I think his history books will be respected in the future as real history.
Right, but he lost his home. He had to sell his home to pay the court cost, and of course his books they were trashed. They were burned.
Yeah,
indeed. And then you also mention in your book about Dr. Charles Lawson, and going back to the reason for death was actually from famine and disease, particularly typhus. And he was a U.S. Army pathologist who went and visited numerous camps and determined that the people died from those three causes, famine, disease, and not from any gassing. He did perform autopsies and whatnot. And yet, what did he later recant his testimony?
Not at all. No, certainly not. No, he was a famous American pathologist, and he wrote his book Coroner to the Stars. Obviously, he has to be slightly oblique in the way he expresses this, to not have been damned as a Holocaust denier all his life. But I think it's pretty clear what you just said is absolutely his attitude. And later on, after he published that book, he was then quoted in his local newspaper saying there never was a case of poisoning by gas found in the German labour camps, that there never was any. He was sent after the war to Dachau and the camps to find out what mortality was due to, and he was put under pressure to say it, to come out with the usual story, and he wouldn't. Okay, he knew what he'd seen there, and as you say, he did not recant, no.
Indeed. Hmm. Well, it's just interesting, when you look back at it, and I think we all grew up believing that the Holocaust happened because of the pervasive propaganda. Mm-hmm. But when you look back at it and start looking at it very scientifically and very logically, and realize that the U.S. government also used Cyclone B for the exact same purpose before they used DDT, then you have to think, well, just the numbers alone, and the fact that there weren't 6 million Jews under German jurisdiction, that people actually have an addiction to fiction, a phrase that was given to me by a friend, and I think that people love fiction, and
do you think the problem is that the story of mass gassings and, oh, you know, there go my parents up the chimney, that is so dramatic, and the reality of the delousing protocols is rather mundane and boring. And do you think there's a problem that the fantasy of all these Jews queuing up to walk into the gas chambers, that is somehow so exciting? Do you think that's the problem?
Sure. And once from different country, the smoke was a different color. And I mean, why wouldn't anybody ask that? But I think, like in my own case...
Just go through that again, Dinah. The smoke being a different colour. Just explain that again.
Well, there's some hocus-pocus about the smoke from different Jews from different countries produced a different color of smoke. And then there of course, is Eli Wiesel, however you say it. He was talking in his book, Night, about these gushers of blood that came out of the ground. And you think, wait a minute. I mean, can anybody really, really believe this stuff?
Well, that shows how religion is formed. I mean, he is the Messiah of the Holocaust. His book has sold 12 million copies, right, Night. He does not have any gas chambers in, because it was published quite early, you see.
Right.
Before the gas chamber method really taken form. And he has huge piles of burning corpses, as if human bodies were inflammable. His whole book is as if you can burn human bodies by throwing them onto piles, okay? And thousands of them burn, and you can see the fire a long way off. Well, actually, you know, this is where we need to teach real science in our schools. Actually, kids, does this sound likely to you? Are human bodies actually inflammable? You know, or you ask an Indian who does cremation how much trouble it is to burn a body. And you know, we can perhaps start to live in the real world a bit. I mean, Eli Wiesel hasn't got a tattoo on his arm. He is the world's biggest liar. It's an identity theft. He's taken the tattoo number of someone else with a similar name, but he has imagined the terrific hallucinatory power of the Holocaust image. And as you say, Diana, that is a real metaphor of God's chosen people. You know, the blood of God's chosen people has to rise up towards the heaven. After it's buried underground, the very earth itself trembles, and the blood of God's chosen people then rises up to heaven. You know, that is a religious story. I'm tempted to say, like some of the stories in the Old Testament, and it is the Holocaustian religion. If you believe that, you know, you'll believe anything.
Sure. And I like the way that you have said this in the book. It says, you say, traditional Christian theology was reversed. Instead of Jews being responsible for killing Jesus, now Christians are charged for the murder of Jews in the Holocaust. It is recognized as a negative culmination of Christianity. So, Christianity lost its basis to exist and must be replaced by a new religion. Works of Holocaust religion converts are full of overwhelming, poisonous, and blasphemous nihilism, matching the aggressive atheism of communists.
Yeah, totally right. Yeah. Cool. Well,
yes.
Well, what can I say? Yeah, I think this is gripping a hold of the world, this Holocaustian religion, and I urge listeners to say no to it.
Right.
Don't be a believer.
And of course, they take children to Auschwitz, and that has become a new church or temple or whatever. And of course, when you look at all the Holocaust museums throughout the world,
Well, in my country, they get taught, brainwashed. They get it rammed down their throat from about the age of 7 onwards. It's the most heavily taught thing in the school syllabus today. I mean, I've asked various people about this. They get Holocausted out with history classes, drama classes, religion classes, they're never allowed to discuss the matter. I'm saying about my partner, someone who teaches history at schools, you know, she has to, oh, they're all wearing these funny striped pajamas and stuff. You know, are you allowed to let them discuss the matter? Can you give them two sides of the matter? Can you let them debate it? No. It's the brain is switched off, and given this, not so much history, more trauma-based mind control, and they're damaged by it. Once you say that, you know, millions of Jews are killed for absolutely no reason, you damage the soul of a kid, not to mention creating deep hatred against Germany. And this should not be allowed. It really shouldn't.
Certainly. Well, I know people who have, and young people are very vulnerable, and as you say, they are damaged by it, but I know people who have just, when they discovered it, when they were told about it, oh, we're going to a break. We'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Be right back. Deanna, and our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom, and he is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality, and the website is whatreallyhappened.info. I was looking in your book. Well, I have it all highlighted and everything. I have so many bookmarks in here, but we're talking about Elie Wiesel, and he's the greatest liar. And you know that in 1981, I never know how to pronounce this. When I met this scoundrel in about 1988-89, I thought they introduced him as Elie Wiesel. But anyway. Yeah. He proclaimed that Christianity had died at Auschwitz and that Pius XII allegedly helped Hitler to carry out the Holocaust. So, it's very interesting that actually more Catholics died at Auschwitz than Jews, but now you have a Pope and Catholics who are embracing this holo guilt, as you call it, and we have a Pope who is kneeling down before the Holocaust. I mean,
I think the wartime Pope did a wonderful job of trying to, I mean, he tried to help a lot of Jews, and he tried to obviously try to avoid taking sides too much in the war. Like just about everyone else around the time, he did not think that there was a Holocaust going on, which he later gets blamed for. Just as the Catholic Church apologised for that, just as the International Red Cross has grovelled with apology for failing to apprehend that the Holocaust was going on, just as British intelligence has apologised for failing to apprehend that the Holocaust was going on. You might ask, who was there around in the war who did think the Holocaust was going around? You read any of the great histories of the war by, you know, Eisenhower, by Winston Churchill, by de Gaulle, huge histories. None of them have any trace of any Holocaust going on or gas chambers. You know, the authentic memories of people there don't actually have a Holocaust going on. I mean, you can read the Italian Primo Levi, a Jew at Auschwitz, who his text is "If This Be a Man." He moans and complains about absolutely everything at Auschwitz as if he was in purgatory, but the fact is he gets fed and clothed, and he doesn't see anyone shot or killed or gassed, and he has some interesting industrial work to do, although obviously he complains about everything. But I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed to find any authentic source of somebody who was there who claimed they did see it going on. So I don't think the Catholics should apologise at all for their Pope.
Sure. And they've thrown out Bishop Williamson, have not supported his when he discovered what he thought about the Holocaust and did some research on it and whatnot. They actually threw him out.
For 20 years. He was a marvelous bishop in America, wasn't he?
Yes, exactly. Okay, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back in 3 minutes. And those decrypts went directly to Churchill. He knew there was nothing going on. He knew that. Okay, we'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kollerstrom, and he is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth, and Reality. The website is whatreallyhappened.info. And we were, a few minutes back, talking about the vulnerability of children who are exposed to this. And I do have a friend that when she first heard about this, she felt such an incredible amount of guilt. I mean, she felt suicidal. And when I learned about it, I had nothing but the deepest empathy for them. And I started reading everything that I could. And I read Nicely's book, which was actually it was fiction. It was just made up. He was never there, just as Eli Wiesel was never there. And when we read something in a book, we think, oh, it must be true. And people are very, very well, they're kind of brainwashed. And of course, this has been very, very deliberate. But when you deliberately destroy a child's mind with fables, that is the most egregious thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes, I mean, I knew someone who took her child away from school because it was being taught to hate by this. And we have got laws prohibiting the generating of race hate. I think we need to demand that both sides be heard in this. In particular, my opinion is all Americans should insist that the Holocaust refers to what was done to Native American Indians. Right? That's the American Holocaust. That's the one that really happened. Okay, it did really happen. And not to some fictional process in Europe, which is made up at Nuremberg. Admittedly, America helped to make it up at Nuremberg. But let's not continue with British-American atrocity propaganda 70 years after the event, okay? It's about time we sobered up, and I suggest that the Holocaust should be taught in schools, and we should have Holocaust memorial museums, but these should be about what happened to Native Americans and not anyone else.
But then, of course, when you look at what the Americans were doing, what the British and the Soviets and Americans were doing, don't you think that the Holocaust was a distraction away from what the destruction that they were engaging in against Germany?
Well, too right. They just perpetrated the greatest war crime ever conceived by man, the systematic incineration of cities, European cities, one after the other. I mean, just incinerating cities, women, children, everyone. And actually, Jews had been sent out to labor camps, were lucky. Okay, they avoided that incinerating process, which is more or less forgotten or not talked about today because there's no story to it. Okay, it just happened. These cities were wiped out, and then after the war, Britain and America decided they didn't want to take the blame for this. Let's make up a new story, and so we can walk away with a moral high ground. So they made these terrific high-sounding Nuremberg principles about genocide, which quite obviously applied to what they had just done.
And what they're continuing to do.
What they continue to do, yeah. It's very dubious that they hung the Germans on the basis of a war of aggression, but we're digressing a bit now, but it's very hard to show that that was aggression. Mainly the countries Hitler went into up until war being declared were, as it were, historic bits of Germany, where people who spoke German and felt they were German and had some claim to being reunited. So the concept war of aggression could not really be defined. And that's partly why it was a military tribunal, that the other side didn't get to state its point of view and wasn't allowed to.
Right.
And was just demonized. I think we live in a civilization with a comic book concept of evil, where you've got the bad guy who is wicked because he's evil, you know, and he has to be destroyed and blown apart. And that is the way the Nazis are always embodied and envisaged in our, not only in fiction, but in actual history books. But they are bad because they're wicked, you know. And that then wickedness can then be projected onto any dissident citizen. If you're not accepting the state's mythology, oh, you must be a Nazi.
Certainly. So and that ties in with the religiosity of the Holocaust. They were evil, and of course they were the destroyers of the chosen people, and so of course they have to be castigated as being the most evil. And you brought up the word comic book, which reminded me of it's kind of a comic book of sorts. It's called Tales of the Holo Hoax, which you referred to in your book.
Yeah, very good text by Michael Hoffman. You know, he's quite profound.
Yes.
Quite a profound character, and he wrote the text, okay, which is why it's rather good.
Yes.
And I think Muslims, being so under attack these days, should republish that Tales of the Holocaust. I mean, I think it's their answer to all the Charlie Hebdo and anti-Muslim stuff we're being fed with non-stop. I would think they should get that out. I think it's pretty well spot on, you know.
Exactly, yes. I love the way that you have laid out the book. You mentioned all of the references to 6 million dying, and this started in 1900 as a result of the Zionist conference in 1897. So in 1900, I believe it was in June, that rabbi, let's see, his name just flew out of my head, that rabbi, what is his name? He mentioned that that 6 million Jews were dying. It was in the New York Times. And many of the references that you have are in the New York Times. But there were 166 times that a Holocaust of the Jews was mentioned in the 45 years. I mean, in major newspapers, but most particularly in the New York Times.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just a hellish mantra that keeps pulsating through the 20th century. It sort of comes out of nowhere and just begins then, and now it infests all of our minds. And it's a sort of collective noun for European Jews, you know, 6 million Jews.
Right. Beginning in 1900. It was Stephen Weiss, yes, in June 11th, 1900.
Yeah, and then it ends up at Nuremberg as a component of the greatest lie ever told. And that is threefold in its essential being, okay? Firstly, the idea that the Germans wanted to exterminate a particular ethnic group, the Jews. Secondly, they did it with huge mass gas chambers. And thirdly, that they did it to 6 million of them. Those are the essential three components of the greatest lie ever told. And that is what you have to believe to be a good citizen and hold down your job and have a pension and have your friends talking to you, okay? That is and that's a kind of analogy with, making an analogy with Christian religion, that is the holy trinity of the Holocaustian religion, okay?
Right. And you did lose some friends?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that was the most terrible thing, because I was so blackened and vilified by the media and by blogs. Suddenly, you know, really old friends suddenly couldn't talk to me anymore. And that was a weird thing. I thought people would come and ask me about my view, you know, what is it you're really saying? But so many of them were shocked and aghast by what they read in the newspaper that, you do lose friends. I mean, you make other ones, okay? Other people, I would say that if you come out, I urge listeners to come out and express your view, find your view and say it and talk about it. Don't be afraid. Do not act out of fear or timidity. You come out that your life and your conversations will be more interesting, that there will be stress and there is obviously some risk if you're in employed. But I do recommend people do it because you're living in the light of truth then.
Which indeed.
Is, without that, your life is kind of empty and meaningless.
Indeed, and that's applicable to scientific investigation into everything. I believe that, as you indicate in your book, that looking at the records at the time that they were created, and the Germans are very, very efficient. They record all their data.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's no document. No document that talks about extermination. And if there were, it would have come out. That would have been the first thing that they would have produced at Nuremberg.
Yeah. Well, the documents that do exist in the latter part of 1942 and the beginning of 43, an urgent commands from the center, the top Nazis, that mortality in the camps must be reduced because the great endeavor to get useful industrial work out of the labor camps cannot succeed with this terrific mortality going on. Let's not underestimate that especially around Auschwitz, it was a nightmare thing with piles of dead bodies, far more than can be burnt, stinking bodies and diarrhea, dysentery, people shitting all over the place. It was a real vision of hell, okay? And that is how the initial story of the Holocaust got going. It was came out of that hellish environment by people. Also, typhus does have an effect of hallucination, that people were getting hallucinatory stories, and the great fiction of the Holocaust came out from that, okay? But in reality, applying the what's called special treatment, whereby everybody coming into the camp, you get showered, you take off your clothes get de-loused, you shave all your hair off, and maybe you get your clothing back or get some other clothing. That was successful, and that once the Zyklon started to be used in the middle of 42, the gas chambers, the ones that did really exist, once they started to be used, mortality went down, not up. Okay, that's the all important thing. The percent monthly mortality was gradually reduced over the course of that year. That's what the data shows.
Right, they were trying to save their workers. They were trying to keep them healthy, and right. And you indicate too in the book how the typhus may have been introduced into the camp.
From bubbles, yeah. I think that was David Irving. He thought that a bunch of Poles introduced it, thinking they could give it to the staff, and instead it broke out. Broke out throughout the camps, in the British intelligence decrypts, there is an account of a whole busload of Poles being taken out into the woods and shot. And I just thought that might be them reaching a judgment and sentencing the Poles for
right.
that. I must say that we occasionally get accounts of people being shot, mainly if they try to escape. Anyone trying to escape would be shot. That is the main thing you hear in the decrypts. Otherwise, Rudolf Hess had strict orders. Any SS guards who mistreated the inmates, struck them, for example, could be court-martialed. And there are trials of SS officers getting dismissed or accused of mistreating the inmates.
Right.
So that's the real Rudolf Hess, the guy who was proud of his camp and ran properly, you know.
Right. Now, you talked about the lesser known camps, Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor.
Yeah.
And, they're different kind of camps. They're transit camps.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they don't have a resident population. This whole endeavor to get industrial work out of the inmates, that is not so for those camps. Those camps are on the eastern border of what was then Poland, okay? They were basically, you'd go for a shower and be sort of de-loused. There was actually a change in the railway gauge as you went from Poland to Russia, so the trains had to change. And Treblinka, for example, what was near that railway station, so you'd have a large population travelling through those camps.
Right.
So they had a different kind of function, the myths that grew up around those camps is quite interesting. For example, there's terrific stories about Treblinka, and at Nuremberg, the story is 800,000 Jews meet their end at Treblinka, okay? And at Nuremberg, it was, they would get steamed. They would be like lobsters, and killed by being steamed, right? And then it was found that this story just did not have credibility, right? People just weren't believing it. So that had to be changed to diesel exhaust gas, right? Everyone knew that the clever Germans had invented diesel, to run their motors on. And the diesel exhaust did smell absolutely frightful, and so the whole story at Treblinka was that 800,000 had been killed by diesel exhaust gas. Okay, that was then told, I think, later on in Nuremberg, when people the boiling like lobster, steaming like lobsters, wasn't very credible. Okay, and then it wasn't for quite a while, again, until the 1980s, people realised that diesel exhaust is not actually lethal. right? Because the whole point about diesel exhaust is that it burns up all the carbon monoxide. There's not enough carbon monoxide in the diesel exhaust to actually kill you. So again, that is embarrassing for the traditional Holocaust story. They've got the big textbooks with people being gassed with diesel exhaust, and it's too late now. They can't change those textbooks. They can't change it a third time. They've really changed the story. They really had two different stories of how these people were gassed. And at Treblinka, you just got a wide expanse of green grass with trees around them, and you've got this fantastic, preposterous story. You've got nobody's shown any gas bodies. Nobody's shown any buried bodies. Nobody's shown any gas chambers, right? There's just nothing there. And you've got this hallucinatory story, 800,000 gassed with a non-lethal gas, and then they're buried, and then, get this, the bodies are dug up and burned.
Right.
Well, if you're fighting a war, would you really want to kill 800,000 people for no reason, bury them, dig them up, burn them, and then scatter their ashes into the river? I mean, who believes this stuff, you know? Why does anyone want to believe a crackpot story like this? I mean, we had Birmingham Science Department, that's a very respectable British university, right? Birmingham Science Department sends this woman over to
Dr. Blinker. Caroline Sturdy Coles.
That's right, yeah. Didn't even bring her homework. And she goes over there, and she has a radar detecting thing that cannot actually detect bodies under the ground, but it detects some boulders, and they've been told by some rabbi that they're not allowed to disturb the dead, okay? So that's why they can't dig. So they're not allowed to dig. And the big headlines, oh, science study refutes revisionist claims. What do they find? I would have thought that rather endorsed the revisionist.
Right. I mean, they didn't find anything except a few rocks. But they couldn't actually detect any human remains. So
no, they couldn't. No. But this shows you the religious nature of the subject, doesn't it? I mean,
right.
To go all the way out there, not be allowed to dig up, have a radar thing which detects some rocks under the ground, and then she says, oh, presumably these are the gas chambers, you know?
Right. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. All righty. We are going to a 3-minute break. We will be right back. Today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlstrom, and he is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust Myth and Reality. The website is whatreallyhappened.info. And I think it's very interesting that, and I believe, maybe reiterated by the Holocaust Memorial Commission, which states that one cannot disturb the ground where the Jewish victims are buried because it's sanctified ground, and so one cannot go about digging them up. So that's why they couldn't do that at Treblinka.
Yeah.
But that is also the case in the Rhine Meadow camps, where the encampments were, with where the enclosures were, the German government will not allow any digging where the camps were, the Eisenhower death camps were. They're not Jewish victims there, but I believe they want to cover the the crime against humanity perpetrated against the Germans, whose status they altered in order to starve them.
Yeah, well, Eisenhower was Jewish, and
that's what they say. But if you, I think he was actually German. I know they called him the Swedish Jew at West Point.
Right. Okay, well, let's remove that. Maybe, I don't know. But the point is, these were the real death camps, okay, after
yes,
the war.
Yes,
you had absolutely real death camps, intentional of slow, agonizing death, and over a million Germans die that way. And would you agree that this was going on while the Nuremberg trials were in progress? This was the amazing hypocrisy, that they were convicting the Germans for a genocide attempt for which they could show no documents. A lot of Nuremberg documents were just kind of made up, by the way, and they kept being read out, and no primary sources were ever alluded to. And at the same time, a real genocide was going on that was not mentioned. It was just off the agenda, okay? The Germans who had surrendered were not allowed to go back to Germany, were not allowed to go home, they were kept and died slowly. Yeah.
Exactly.
That is the horror of the situation. We have to makes you ask, what was the point of the Second World War supposed to be? To destroy the spirit of a nation like this, not just to crush it militarily.
Right. And it wasn't just Hitler that they were after. According to some of the bankers, they said they were going to go after the Germans themselves. And this was something that was occurring, and a feeling that they had long before Hitler ever entered the picture. It was certainly, during World War II, World War I, and even before that. So, you can't say that it was, they were just after Hitler. No, it wasn't that they were just after Hitler.
Yeah.
They were just after Germany.
Yeah, well, Germany always yearned for friendship with Britain, for alliance of friendship with Britain, First World War and the Second World War, and it could never be. And anyway, let's not get too much into generalizations. Just in the late 30s, Germany did the frightful, intolerable thing. It had its own bank, issued its own currency free of Rothschild's central bank control. Okay?
Right. So
they had a national bank, and that was maybe the key to the tremendous regeneration of Germany in the 1930s, having a national bank in which money was debt free. It was not interest at source, and it was under the control of Germany. And I believe that's the only European nation in the 20th century which managed to do that. And if you look in the mid 30s, the statesmen were full of praise for National Socialism and what it was achieving, and then suddenly, once that happens, it becomes, the arch fiend, and the devil himself has appeared on earth, and it cannot be vilified enough.
Sure. Even Churchill had some wonderful things to say about the economic situation, and but then all of a sudden, everything kind of switched, and all of a sudden they had to declare economic warfare in the spring of 1933 in order to halt this, because certainly if it worked well in Germany, it would work well in the other European countries.
Yeah, they managed economic recovery despite the terrific worldwide boycott by international Jewry, who had declared war against Germany, and Germany needed trade in order to get the food to live on. It wasn't self-sufficient in food, and it did manage this despite this enormous boycott. But at the end of the decade, they decided to put Jews into separate camps to get them out from the main population, obviously they're very much condemned by for doing that. But it seems to me rather similar to what America did after Pearl Harbor, that they put Japanese into camps, as enemy aliens.
Right. Well, they also put Germans into labor camps, and let's talk a little bit. Now you mentioned. Oops, we got to go to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Back in 3 minutes. back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom. He is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. Now, in your book, you talk about the primary source records, which I always encourage people to look at. You've talked about the four different different records, primary source records, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which visited the camps and kept meticulous records of the identities of those died and their cause of death. And you talk about the death books that the Soviets seized and that were returned in 1989 by President Gorbachev. And then you talk about the Bad Ehrlson, also called the International Tracing Service. And these records consist of three sets, that the first set was released in 1979, listed the total deaths as 271,301. The second set in 1983, which lists 282,077. And the third set in 1993, which lists 296,081. And then you talk about the British intelligence decrypts that went directly to Churchill and provide the most authentic information about camp life. And then another set of records, which I would refer to as compiled records, which are not, well, they're compiled. It means people created them. They devised them out of thin air. They devised them out of myth and out of, well, nonsensical kinds of things. And those are the records at Yad Vashem, their database. And how did they create their database? Now, I've been there. I went there in, 1999 in Jerusalem, and it is like a mausoleum, and it's very somber and very church-like and very, there's no guide there. You can't ask any questions. You press a button to find out what it is you're looking at. But how did they create their database?
Well, let me first just add what you're saying about the Bad Ehrlson, 290,000. That is the total number of recorded deaths in all the German labor camps throughout World War II. Okay, and I recommend that we can add a bit on for unregistered deaths. Okay, some deaths would have been unregistered, but it's not going to go a lot above 300,000. And so you've got less than 200,000 Jews dying in all the German labor camps. I think that's a quite reliable number. Okay.
Yes.
Now, coming on to the Yad Vashem, you can show that if you put in deaths in Siberia into that, you can search it and so on the web, right? So you can try search it for things. You put in deaths in Siberia, you'll get a thousand cases. Okay, Jews who died in Siberia, and it's got a whole lot of duplicated data in, and it seems like any Jews who died anywhere within sort of 10 years of that time can go into it. And I think the number's about 4 million now, and no doubt it will soon go up 6 million. You can't really check. You can't, for example, run the names alphabetically to see who they got or how many times they duplicate a name. There's a whole lot of people, say, who died, say, for example, in Hungary after the war. You can put in their names and you'll find that they're in the database. So it would be nice if we could get, say, all of the A's and compare that with the Alison archive, all of the A's.
That would be excellent.
You know, that kind of rudimentary, normal, straightforward scholarly analysis would dispel the miasma, you know. But of course you can't do that. You can't do normal analysis of this kind. I suggest that database is, as you've indicated, just hocus pocus. It can't in any way be taken seriously. It's a centre of the New World Religion. That's what it is.
Right. Do you think that Churchill or any of the Eisenhower, Churchill, or Stalin ever regretted or felt guilty about what they did at Nuremberg?
No, not at all. No, they just walked away, they'd done it. And the mythology of the good war, which fought against evil, had been created, and that saved their bacon. It meant that nobody ever had to discuss why 60 million people died in World War II. You just have to mention one or two words, Auschwitz and Hitler, and that's enough. And if it's not enough for you, then you must be some sort of wicked, Nazi or... you're something ethically wrong if that's not enough. So the simple duality that we're given of good guys versus bad guys is established by that by what they did at Nuremberg.
Right.
Is what we know is called a psyop. For example, that they went to the labor camps in Germany. And they put in a false ceiling into the shower unit, and with holes in it, and it was good enough to fool visiting American senators, and these were allegedly the gas chambers, okay? So originally there were various camps in Germany that had alleged gas chambers in for Nuremberg, okay? But as soon as after the war Germans were allowed to visit them, the credibility vanished. They could see that it was just a made-up job. And so these were then non-functional gas chambers or whatever. But the idea of mass gas chambers were only where you weren't allowed to go to. It's important to appreciate this, that the Iron Curtain came down after the war in the East and you could not go to Poland. So the whole mythology of the gas chambers flourished in a place which traditionally hated Germany and you weren't allowed to go and visit it. And that's why the hoax, preposterous hoax, lasted for so long.
Right. And Churchill himself said that he knew that history would be very kind to him because he planned to write it himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was the great war maker. He loved war more than anything else, didn't he?
Oh, indeed. In 1936... he said, "We will force Hitler into the war whether he wants it or not," unquote. So he knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
The people, the warmongers in England, put him in. I mean, he was part of the warmongers in the parliament. And they took out the other Chamberlain and put Churchill in because they knew that they could count on Churchill to give him a war.
Yeah. Well, Chamberlain, yes, he was very uneasy. He's cast as a sort of dithering fella. Anyway, let's not go into the vast, immense question.
Let's not do
the right and wrong
things.
Of World War II. Yeah. I mean, one thing I urge people to do in this book is keep the discussion to a fairly limited factual area.
Sure.
But don't go into the vast cosmic miasma of the right and wrong of World War II, which so many thousands of books have been written. Keep a focus.
Yes.
On what happened to the German.
I'm addressing some of the issues in the chat room. Somebody made some comments in the chat room that I'm trying to clarify without doing that. But let's get back to, speaking of websites, let's visit your website, whatreallyhappened.info. Did you want to say any more about Yad Vashem?
I think it's hate crime what they're doing. They're formulating a fictional narrative in which Germans exterminated Jews, every single one, if they could. They wiped out the whole Jewish populations in Hungary and so forth, and that is not only fictional, but it is, I think it's hate crime what they're doing, and if we have got the category hate crime, I think they should be accused of it, and it's not history. I appreciate it's the sacred center of a religion, but it's a false slave religion which we, the Goyim, need to reject.
Right. And you've talked about all of the UN created these legislation, actually, which addresses the crimes, the thought crimes, and all of that. And gosh, I mean, it seems that there are a lot of people that that should be abiding by the policies that were introduced afterward, and yet it only seems applicable to a certain group. I mean, you talked about, let's see, I'm looking in the appendices here.
Yeah, well, we've got legislation right across the center of Europe now, banning doubt. You know, doubt is a crime.
Right.
And most shocking thing, Russia just recently adopted it, the whole of Russia.
Yes.
Hungary adopted it. So right across the middle of Europe, I think with the exception of Holland, you've got doubt is a crime. You're going to be put in jail. This discussion we're having now, you know, you'd just be put into jail. So I think we're lucky to be
right.
in countries where it's not a crime. But certainly Europe is in a bad state at the moment with this legislation. But as I think you're indicating with your question, the legislation is of the form that they can't say, well, it's illegal to doubt, blah, blah, blah. They always have to put it in the form to have a belief that might cause a disturbance of the peace.
Right.
Right? Which is not as such banning it. So I would urge anyone who gets the arm of the law reaching out to them on this matter to be absolutely clear of your innocence, because there's no way the debate we're having now can cause a disturbance of the peace. That's a totally fake concept, that
sure.
publishing a book or a belief will cause a disturbance of the peace. It's far more the other way around, that the Holocaust prosecutors who go into people's libraries and check through libraries and terrorise people, that is the disturbance of the peace, in fact.
Right. Well, you say in the book that there's only one book that has ever done that, is the one that was produced by Marx and Engels, The Communist Manifesto, in 1848, and that's really the only book that you refer to in here that really did cause people to take action or to implement some sort of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, books do not disturb the peace.
Right.
I mean, the peace is disturbed by people with loud megaphones or guns or leaflets. That's what disturbs the police, the peace.
Sure.
I mean, the idea of a book disturbing the peace is actually absurd, you know?
Right. Exactly. And you talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights, and several of these things, which... gosh, I mean, it's just, and you talk about hate crime as opposed to actual deeds. You can't even think of something that might be interpreted as doubt. It doesn't even have to be a deed. All you have to do is doubt something.
Well, I think, in principle, these cases should be winnable. That's what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
You've got to have a belief in your own innocence and learn how to use the legal language, and you're actually a peace-loving citizen. What you mustn't do in a trial, just for anyone who does get accused, is try to defend the truth of what you've said. That will annoy the court, and it happens in European trials that is just further aggravates your guilt, okay? That is not the course of action take. The course of action take is that you're not in any way threatening a breach of the peace. You're not threatening any ethnic group. You're not threatening a breach of the peace, not at all. And if anybody says you are, it's the onus is on them to provide evidence for it, which, of course, they can't do.
Right. Okay, let's visit your website. It's very impressive. It's just incredibly impressive. I know that many people have contributed to the website. There's so many resources here that people can access. But on the right-hand side, you have all of these wonderful links. And people can visit this and click on. You could spend weeks, months, just going through the the information, the resources that you have on the website. Now, you mention a couple of interesting people. You mention, well, Dennis Avey, who Carolyn Yeager talked about a couple of years ago. And you talk about Anne Frank. And a lot of people, or I should say, that people will often use these stories like Anne Frank to say, oh yes, this happened because I read the Diary of Anne Frank when I was a kid. And so people can relate to her because she's a child. Now, if that diary had been written by her, by an adult, it wouldn't have as much impact. When in fact, and it says in the Tales of the Holocaust, there's a reference to the Anne Frank diary that she went forward and somehow she was able to use a ballpoint pen that hadn't actually been invented till when was it, 1953, 1951. But she was able to somehow transcend time and use ballpoint pen, which I thought was very cleverly put.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I gather that scholars aren't allowed to have access to the original manuscripts to see, compare who actually wrote the thing. You know, this is a sacred relic that you're not allowed to scrutinize. But what might be important is that she and her father go to Auschwitz, and her father gets put in a hospital where he's looked after, and he recovers, okay? And then... and then, when it's liberated, Anne Frank then goes westwards on this march to another camp where she finally succumbs to typhus. She doesn't die in a camp, and her father there recovers and gets better. That might be the important thing, really.
Right. All these people seem to get better, and they always choose to go with the Germans rather than the Soviets.
Yeah. Well, Eli Wiesel, likewise. He was in a...
Yes, and he wasn't even there, but he still chose to go with the Germans. Okay. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlstrom. He is the author of a wonderful book, Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality, which is available at Amazon. I highly recommend that you purchase this book. It's just a very good read. Very, very good read. Wonderful, wonderful book. And the website is whatreallyhappened.info. And we were talking right before the break about how everyone chose to go with the Germans, even Eli Wiesel. I'm not sure how to say his last name, but anyway.
Well, L-I-E is part of his name, which might be no coincidence.
Yeah, especially with the L-I-E. Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a signed copy of his book, and it's in very good shape. I mean, it's almost like new. But I only had to read a couple pages, and I thought, this guy is, this is beyond belief.
Well, it's been an object of study in so many American universities, isn't it?
It's amazing.
You know, a textbook, as if it were real history. And it's just frightening. How can people think this is real history? And so much of what is called the Holocaust involves complete negating of basic laws of physics.
Right.
I mean, we live in a physical universe where human bodies don't burn. And especially in Auschwitz, the ground was damp. There were various rivers around it, which is why it was chosen for an industrial work, having rivers around. The ground was damp, with a high water table, and you couldn't possibly dig a pit and burn bodies.
Of course not.
And so there's a basic absolute physical impossibility in these things that is just somehow the vividness of the imagination of people telling this hullahoke story overcomes the physical, the basic physical science of what could not have happened, you know.
Right. Well, you say in your book that bodies are 70% water, and how could you possibly get a whole bunch of bodies in a pit where the water table is so high because of the three rivers conjoining right at that point? And how could you possibly get a body to burn? That, I think you may have mentioned in your book also, that if you got a chicken and held a match under it to try to light it a fire, it just wouldn't happen. You could not burn that chicken.
You could not, no.
Yes.
But in Schindler's List, in the Spielberg film Schindler's List, you do see these burning pyres, and you don't see a human gas chamber. It's quite interesting that the human gas chamber cannot actually be envisaged. It's purely a phantom horror image, okay? Nobody can really depict it. It's like the, you know, witches were burnt a few centuries ago in Europe, and there was the hallucinatory image of the witches' Sabbath that they'd all go to, right? And that was the basis for them being tried and found guilty and burnt. So likewise, you've got the imagined gas chamber, which can't really be physically depicted, because it'd be quite physically impossible. You couldn't have a huge gas chamber like that working. And no huge human gas chamber has ever existed in human history, okay?
Right.
And so that is a hallucination that then...
A mass hallucination. Now, we have another hour. I know that you're quite a few hours ahead. Are you willing to stay for another hour?
Oh, another hour. Oh.
And we'll take some questions?
Okay. Well, I'll try to. I'll just go and get a cup of tea, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom. He is the author of a fabulous book, Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. The website is whatreallyhappened.info. And we do invite your phone calls at 800-313-9443. Someone in the chat room asked, If I got a picture of Eli Wiesel's tattoo, and he actually does not have one. He said that he has one on his left wrist, and when Eric Hunt attempted to see if he has a tattoo on his left wrist, then Wiesel actually had him sued him, and he spent some time in jail, which is a terrible thing. I mean, if a guy is going to go around saying that he is somebody that he isn't, and that he was a prisoner, you would think that the least that he would do is to go to some tattoo parlor and have the A177 or whatever number that he was supposed to have on his wrist tattooed on his wrist so that he could say, see my number? But he doesn't, he's not even creating any evidence other than his profit producing books that, this one, Knight, sold, I don't know how many copies, 10 million copies? I think
yeah,
your book's 10 million?
Yeah.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
How can he do that? How can he chat with President Obama and stuff if the tattoo isn't even on his shoulder? I just don't get how he can go through life and get away with it.
Exactly. You know? And he's saying, he's giving Obama a bad time because he hasn't bombed Iran yet. But anyway, we do have some callers.
Isn't that amazing? He can even instruct a president who to bomb, you know?
Exactly. Who the heck does this guy think he is?
You know, anyway. He went to Hungary a few years ago. I said, look, it's shocking that you haven't got laws banning denial of the Holocaust. You know, you've got to do that. And so they did. Hungary's now passed a law because Eli Wiesel told them to.
Wow.
Doubt is a crime. You know? Some kind of power is somehow acquired as the Messiah of the Holocaust, really. The Messiah
indeed.
Of the Holocaust.
And he was also the person that was the head of the Holocaust Memorial Commission, appointed by, who appointed him? Carter. Carter appointed him the head of the commission. Put this guy who'd never been in a camp, just put him to the head of the class and he became the head of the commission. Unbelievable. Based on a big fat lie. Okay, why don't we take some callers?
I think that's what's called chutzpah. Chutzpah.
Yes, they have a lot of that. Yes. He may not have the tattoo, but he's got a lot of nerve. Okay, let's take Frank in North Carolina. Frank, welcome.
Yes, Deanna, thanks for taking my call. I had a question for you, and the guest, the doctor. Now, something's come across my radar this week that I've never heard before, and I'm not a big researcher of the Holocaust or anything. I am a skeptic of the Holocaust, but I've always been kind of a World War II buff since I was a child, and I've also been the recipient of incredible amounts of propaganda about the Holocaust over the years, and there's something came across my radar this week that I've never come across. I don't recall ever having heard it, and I wonder if you or your guest has ever come across it, that the Jewish prisoners, the Holocaust victims, had been forced to wear wooden shoes.
They were
run and escape.
Well, they were given, they were given sort of new clothing, and I think the regulation shoes could be uncomfortable. Yeah, so sometimes they had these shoes and didn't like them. I can't comment a lot on that.
I can't either.
I just think it's very interesting. I've seen people that have those shoes. I guess the Dutch wore them, and they have the decorative paint and designs on them with the little flowers and stuff. But I can remember as a child growing up, every now and then you might see those decoratively placed somewhere in the house of someone. I don't think they were Jewish, but I just thought that was very odd. That if that is the case, I would have never heard of that. And presumably,
I think partly it was the acid. Of for the risk of typhus, they didn't want people to have their old clothing at least for a while, there was a war going on and conditions were tough. Certainly those shoes were uncomfortable.
I think there's I don't see any pictures that might corroborate that there were wooden shoes, I mean, it's an interesting theory. Did you have another comment?
Well, I would have thought that they would have made sure that they had some close-up photographs of these horrible, painful, torturous shoes that they had been made to wear all those years, if that was the case. But I had one other comment, something that was said, with these Noahide laws and everything that are coming out. I'm hearing that that a lot of most people don't know about those, but also just based on what I've heard, my theory, this is going to be used by, I understand that members of the associated or connected with the Jewish mafia, the syndicate, whatever you want to call it, criminal syndicate in America, are actually going to be probably using that to go after dissidents, anyone who is skeptical or speaks out against the so-called interest of the international Jewry or even Israel. And that's all I have.
Okay. Getting back to the shoe thing, I mean, if people are going to be working and they need to keep everybody healthy, it doesn't seem logical to me that they would give them shoes that might cause blisters, because blisters can get infected. They can be very dangerous. I think that you would have too many people going to the infirmary or to the hospital with issues. So I really don't think that they would want to give them something that's going to cause a possible discomfort level that might cause them to not be able to work. And these were labor camps. These were and they worked at the industry that was built up around these camps. And there were two camps, one for those Auschwitz, for those that were able to work, and Birkenau, which was very close, was for those that were not able to work. So I don't think that they would do something like that, in as much as they were trying to keep these people healthy. What do you think, Doctor?
Author, if this be a man, he does mention being given shoes which he didn't like, but I can't remember him saying they were wooden. I don't remember that bit, but they weren't given clothing that they would complain about. You know, it wasn't warm enough, or the shoes were not comfortable. But the point is that it did cure the typhus.
Right.
By the way, there's one other monograph about Auschwitz, which I'd just like to mention. It's the international bestseller called Man's Quest for Meaning by a psychologist, Victor Frankl.
Yes.
You know, that is a grand epic, and it presents Auschwitz as a kind of anvil of the soul. Like, if you survive life in Auschwitz, you survive anything. So life is tough there. But he's there. He's a psychiatrist, and originally he's got a job of treating people who want to commit suicide, to talk them out of Germans, to talk them out of wanting to commit suicide, trying to get their morale back. And he's in Auschwitz. And then, as a Jew, he gets sent out to another camp, I think it's Dachau, where his medical services will be better used. Okay, so his biography is actually an example of what I mentioned earlier, how they're trying to put people to use in the different camps. And he spends a while in Auschwitz, and then he gets sent out to a different camp where his skills could be more acquired, his doctor's
exactly.
Medical skills.
That was one of the first books I read, too, when I was a teenager, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And it was very impactful.
It doesn't have the integrity of the one I mentioned earlier, because he accepts the gas chamber legend, right?
Right.
So, in other words, he has the demonized wicked Nazis.
Right.
And I would say that's a moral failure. I would say it's a moral failure if you give in to that cushy illusion. Once you've got an image of pure evil, the people who are evil because they're wicked, and you have to fight against them, that kind of gives you an answer about your the meaning of life. It's a fake, bogus answer, but it's a very easy answer that a lot of people take.
Indeed.
So I would say that is one point against it. But generally speaking, I would say that is a book which people can appreciate reading about Auschwitz.
Indeed. Yes. And it was a powerful book, I think, for other reasons, I think, too. But anyway, I was influenced by it. Okay. We thank that the caller. Let's go on to Fred in Iowa. Fred?
Yeah. Hi, Deanne.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Callers are very handicapped. They have to talk in the sound bites, and they don't get much time. So I would like to make three statements and then ask a question and a chance to reply to the answer to the question.
Okay,
may
go
I?
Ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I do not hate Catholics. I am not a Catholic and will not be one. But I think they are misled and ill-informed. I do not hate Christians, although I am a Protestant Christian, I strive to be. But I think they are grossly misled and ill-informed, and our Protestant churches have been infiltrated and corrupted. I do not hate Jews, and I think ethnic Jews have been brainwashed, misled, and ill-informed.
Okay, and now your question.
Okay, my question is this. The protocols of the learned elders of Zion, why would that be published? Who would it hurt? Use logic and sense. And I would like an answer to that question and a chance to reply. Thank you.
Okay. Are you asking Dr. Collerstrom or me?
Well, first of all, this does not have a great deal of relevance to our subject. I've got to say
right.
that, okay? That's way, way off topic. It was published in 1905 by a Russian monk called Nihilus, and he published it in Russia because he felt it was important for the world. That is the answer to the question.
Okay. Okay. So, you know, who's gonna read it? Who's read it? I don't know. People don't read much anymore. Okay, Fred,
well,
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to Ed. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hello, Dan and Dr. Nicholas. How are you guys?
Good.
Oh, yeah, very well, thanks, Ed. Yeah.
I've got a question and a comment. For the question is, was there ever any documents that were authentic ever recovered which indicated the purpose and all for all these camps? Was there ever any documents published about that?
Well, Ed, if I may take that question, I would say that there were the documents indicate two different purposes of the camps. The first one was the expulsion and movement of Jews eastwards, the huge diaspora of Jews during World War II, whereby after the war, the main centres of Jewry had been in East Europe, and after the war they ended up in Israel and America as the main centres of Jewry. So there was a huge global movement of Jews, and the expulsion from Germany was part of that. Now, Hitler and the National Socialists had a plan for Jews to go to Madagascar. That was a paradise island, hardly inhabited, and that was the favoured destination, and the aim of trying to expel European Jews was to get them out there. Now, that was the initial, documents show that was the initial purpose, and a book has recently been published showing that. And that then proved impossible. I think it was very much the British stopping any such export. And so you had a whole lot of Jews in Europe who could not be moved out to any such final or ultimate destination. And instead, during 1942, a secondary intention developed of getting useful labour out of the people, and all sorts of industries developed. Now, your very important question is quite hard to answer because it's so much suppressed. For example, at Auschwitz there was huge chemical industries at Monowitz for getting coal out of coke, for example, by catalytic chemistry, to enable the whole German war effort to take place with synthetic petrol. And likewise rubber, they made synthetic rubber complicated chemistry. I mean, have you ever heard that there were five blast furnaces operating at Auschwitz? It was a main industrial centre for the German war effort. Auschwitz was the biggest camp, and it had this terrific industrial purpose. And we're hardly allowed to be told anything about this. You know, we're given pictures of inmates hanging around in striped pyjamas, waiting to be gassed. And that is just fiction, and we're not given or shown documents about the real purpose of these camps. I mean, there are one or two books, actually by a chap called Dr. Piper, who was in charge of the archive at Auschwitz, the museum, which will describe all these documents, which must be all in German, right? I can't actually read German, so I can't tell you a lot about them to answer your question. Okay, does that answer your question?
Yes, pretty much, and you understand why I'm asking the question is to legitimize the purpose of the camps from the very beginning to disclose the ignorance of believing that it was for anything else. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, you know, if the Fuhrer said that the camps were for containing people until he decided what to do with them or whatever after the war, which is what actually David Irving said.
Yeah.
Because there was an officer that actually asked him, what are we going to do with the people in the camps? And he said, well, we're not going to make that decision until after the war. And he had a document to that effect, right? And so that's the reason I asked the question, because it would destroy the argument of the Holocaust anyway. If we knew that the camps weren't designed for exterminating anybody, it was actually working.
Yeah.
They were residential, so that they could work for the German war effort. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Thank you. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Kohlerstrom, and he is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth and Reality. The website is What Really Happened. And Ed, did you have another comment or question?
Yes, what I wanted to, if he's not aware of it, I heard Eustace Mullins in an interview one time, or in a meeting one time, say that, talking about the Second World War, that in order, they were doing different things to entice Germany to attack the United States, and one of the things they were doing in New York, where they were actually murdering Germans right on the street and making it open and notorious and letting Germany know about it, to entice them to attack the United States. And the information that I'm talking about is recounted in a book called Intrepid. And so I didn't know if he knew about that or not.
Wow. Amazing.
I think that sometimes Eustace did say things that weren't quite accurate. And I don't think that the Germans had the capability to attack the United States, so I don't think that that would happen. And there were Germans here in prison camps that they seized down in South America, that lived in other countries, and brought them up here for incarceration. But I've never heard that.
No.
Well, that's what, if you get the book Intrepid and read it, you'll see that that's what the author was saying, was that was the reason they were murdering these Germans right on the streets in New York City prior to the war, to try to entice Germany to do anything against the United States to give us reason to get into the war.
I think they had a backdoor reason to be with the Pearl Harbor thing, and they had that going pretty well. They put sanctions on the Japanese, and so they had another way of getting us involved in the war.
Yeah,
so that seemed to work really well for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, thank you, Ed.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's take David in California. David?
I just wanted to say, well, I'm sure both of you know it, in 1989, or somewhere around right there, in Auschwitz, they removed the stone that said 4 million died here,
yeah,
in place of 1.5 million. So that's 2.5 million difference. And David Dees in his illustration shows that clear in the part on the left where it says numbers. So That was about the main point. And I was wishing Fred could call back because I didn't hear his reply after he wanted to reply. It was kind of interesting what he was saying because I do feel the, even though it's not directly with the subject, but the protocols does fit into, you know, this whole mechanization of whatever they'll do to help.
Yeah, it does in a general way. Yeah,
generally, but anyway.
So I think that's one of the best points with the at the Auschwitz in general talking that should be brought up. Why can't Abe Foxman go over when he brings the Israeli people? Of course he wouldn't, obviously. I'm sure they avoid that, like the plague, that part.
Yeah, notice how the 6 million total didn't change at all. When they knocked the title down, they knocked 3 million off the total from 4 million down to 1 million. Died at Auschwitz. That didn't affect Auschwitz and Birkenau. That didn't affect the total. The magic 6 million mantra at all, did it?
Common core math, yeah.
Right.
6 million subtract 2.5 million equals 6 million. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Okay. Right.
I'm good. Indeed. That's about all I wanted to talk about.
That's a whole lot of maths for you.
Thank you, David. Okay, let's take Werner in Canada. Werner, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Werner, and good afternoon to your guest, Mr. Colostrum.
Yes, good afternoon to you, yes.
Well, I hope...
It's the middle of night for me. It's night time for me.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you for staying over.
You have 5 hours... No, 4 hours ahead of the Atlantic Canada.
Right.
But hopefully all this, the information that's been put out now, it will gain more and more momentum among most of us people. And that we hope that those that are still asleep, that they finally wake up to the facts and to reality.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing more, in this 21st century, there's nothing more important than the struggle to find out, the historical truth. Historical truth becomes absolutely central because we're being manipulated by people, by powers who've somehow got access to the government that give us fictional fabricated untruth. And the fictional fabricated untruth always has the purpose of ratifying the war and of justifying the next war. And if we want to live in a culture of peace, we need to demand that these historical hate-generating myths are dismantled. And we need to get angry at whoever is responsible for making them in the first place and try and develop a Pacific culture in which we don't actually need to hate other countries.
Basically, what I am hearing here, those arguments from the other side, it reminds me of what I've read about the Inquisition. That had been done for centuries by the Catholic Church. Oh, we got another Inquisition vote.
Okay, Werner, we'll keep you over the break. We do need to break for 3 minutes, so gentlemen, we will be right back. Deanna, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, is 800-313-9443. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Colerstrom, and he is the author of Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth, and Reality. A wonderful, wonderful book. I highly recommend that you purchase it. And the website is whatreallyhappened.info. And we were talking to Werner. And Werner.
Yeah, Diana. I mentioned there about the Inquisition. The people got burnt at the stake and everything. Other imaginary cruelty were being committed in order to get people to conform to their doctrine. But we still had something going on after the war. When I was living over there in Germany in the 50s and 60s, when I grew up, we happened to listen to the Eastern Germans from the communist side through their radio broadcast and so, just in order to sometimes to get a laugh out of it. But it was not really anything to laugh about. And the indoctrination and the political lies, political dialectic that was being pushed by the communist system. And now it has come full turnaround in the so-called free West.
Must have been very difficult.
Most of the countries have adapted this, or basically are now being controlled by the very same forces.
Indeed. And do you have a comment, Doctor?
Not really, no. I'll just leave that.
Okay.
Yeah. Diana, something else about this myth about the wooden shoes. Again, I grew up on a farm, and in the late 40s and early 50s, I saw a lot of farmers wearing wooden shoes when they were doing their work in the barn and standing on and walking on the concrete floor. They had warmer feet.
Ah.
And especially those factory workers, and when they were standing hour for hours on a concrete floor, you know, it kept them, they had warm feet with it, and cold feet, they can cause a lot of trouble and a lot of sickness all through the body.
Ah. Well, I think that in a country that was running out of supplies and basic necessities, well, you use what you have. So, anyway, thank you so much for your comments. We always appreciate hearing from you.
Diana, may I say something? One more point.
Sure, sure.
How many editions have been printed from and published and sold of the Talmud, and how many editions have been printed and sold of the Bible?
I have no idea. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Well,
okay.
Let's keep off religion. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. Thank you so much, Werner, for calling in. I really appreciate it. Okay, let's take Mike in South Carolina. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hello, Diana and Doctor.
Hi.
Hi, yeah.
Very good program. A lot of good information. A lot of territory being covered. Werner brought up something very interesting I was calling about. And that is, and before I get started, I'd like to take my glass of French wine and give Werner a big salute day. We have some serious issues with economics, of course. You know that, Diana and Doctor, in world economics. And this is something I'd like to ask both of your opinions about seriously. And that is that every time America seems to get into a mess, it always seems like a Jewish opinion or Jewish setup is what we're getting into. We have been there in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I've noticed also that Merkel in Germany and former president of France, Sarkozy, and a little-known Greece, Papandreou, are all Jewish. And I think what's happening is they're being set up in these countries and other countries to take the countries into total indebtedness. So when they leave after they're serving their times, then the problems are somebody else's problem. In other words, the Jewish control is setting these countries up along with indigenous people in a situation where they can't get out of it. And quite frankly, when this economic condition does start dropping here pretty soon, I think what we need to do, along with Greece and Italy and the other France, is simply tell the Jewish powers to be that it's their debt, not ours, and we're done with them.
I'd like to have your
opinion about if you think that this economic situation has been created deliberately, willfully, and intentionally, as it always has been, by these people.
Well, yeah, I don't think Angela Merkel is Jewish, actually. I mean, do you want to persuade us about that, or... That's not the main point you're making, but I'm just surprised at that.
I don't know.
She may be married to a Jewish person, but I think it's irrelevant. You don't have to be Jewish in order to follow the economic situation or to implement an economically disadvantage on your country. But
these people have all been—they've been set up as puppets.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Every politician in Germany since the end of the war has been established as friendly, or I mean, they don't even have a constitution. They never ended the war.
Go ahead and
answer that, Doctor.
Well, you're right. They were given a constitution they had to sign by the victorious Allies, and given legislation.
Right.
So they don't have their own constitution, yeah. I mean, this is the vast question of extent to which tens of Jews get up into controlling positions that you mentioned, a deep question for the human race. I'd rather not get too much into it, actually.
Right.
Well, some of the hearsay, Deanna, one last comment, hearsay on the street is that a lot of the Jews are coming over from Israel into America, about 20,000 a month. And part of that tribe is also looking in Africa, and I think what's going to end up happening is that they're going to pick a country in Africa, like South Africa and Zimbabwe have been beaten all to heck with, and they're going to find another country down there to settle into and start breeding with the indigenous people down there, and they're going to create a brand new tribe called the Chosen Kaka tribe.
Right.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I think they've always been, they like to be ethnically independent, and in fact they've retained their ethnicity a lot better than the rest of us. The rest of us seem to be very, very multicultural. But they seem to stick together. They're very close-knit, and they've maintained that unity for some time. And I think it's the function of the rabbis that held them together as a unit. What are your thoughts?
I mean, the East European Jews came out from the Khazars in what's now the Russian Empire in the East,
right.
and as that empire disintegrated, they moved westwards into countries that are now, you know, Romania, Hungary, and so on, and they were there for 1,000 years.
Right.
That's how there was the great concentration of Jews in East Europe, up to sort of 10% or so of the population. And then the huge diaspora.
In Kiev,
they
also have other Jewish puppets there too, and see, it's the same scenario over and over and over again. Is we're dealing with Jewish puppets, and that's just something that's got to be stopped.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, we always appreciate your phone call, and certainly.
I always think whenever you look at these great problems, it always seems to me the first thing to do is dissolve the mythology of the Holocaust. That's the first thing, a step, I think, for resolving this kind of problem. As long as that terrific mythology is there, we're not going to get anywhere with it.
Sure. And that is how they gain power. That is how they have gained power, is by using the Holocaust to gain sympathy, to impose guilt, to gain influence, to gain money, to be able to impose the Holocaustianity on an entire nations, I should say. And certainly that contributes to people's ignorance and enables the Jews to have so much power guilt can play an awful, it's an awful thing to use to get people to do things that you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Alrighty. Well, if anybody has, would you agree with that?
Well, I think there's a general question. Gilad Atzmon's very good on this. He's book, The Wondering Who.
Oh, yes. Isn't he wonderful?
Yeah, about Jewish history being always rather shaky and miasmal business. And it's to keep the goyim in their place by having this history. We've all been given these stories in the Old Testament. It's more and more evident that archaeology won't confirm them at all. And they're sort of vast mythic motifs in which that God acts in a mysterious way, and maybe the Holocaust has some of these characteristics that generate a deep religious fervour that maybe is sort of part of our nature to need. And I think we need to believe, we've got to believe that there's a future without this terrific belief.
Right.
That we have actually been lied to so badly for so long is what people feel difficult, find it hard to believe. And if we can shed this belief, then we can start moving towards a worthwhile future.
Right. And of course, they use emotion rather than science in order to implement their programs. And
yeah.
I think that a lot of the, from my own research, I think that many of the things that have happened, the so-called pogroms, are actually implemented and orchestrated by the very people, by themselves, such as Kristallnacht, was something that they were very much involved with. They had a network that was where they were able to implement this throughout Germany, all at the very same time. And when you look at the pogroms in Russia, and which coincided, by the way, with all the propaganda in the newspaper, and all of the people who were saying, oh gosh, there's 6 million people, you know, suffering and vulnerable in Russia or elsewhere. So I think they've always had a communication network since about, even before the so-called Civil War, in which they could communicate and synchronize operations.
The Civil War, does that mean the Civil War in England you're talking about?
Well, the one here in this country.
All right. Yeah. Well, the Civil War in England was the time when they were readmitted into this country after they'd been banished for 3 centuries. So we have a story of the so-called Bank of England being set up by Jewish money from Amsterdam with this debt. The national debt began then as this bank began issuing money. And, you know, we've got more and more in debt ever since.
Right.
But anyway, there is a sort of huge global story. I mean, what Germany did in the late 1930s was basically what every country in Europe has done at one time or another. You know, decide they've got to chuck out the Jews.
Right.
And instead of bleating about anti-Semitism, I think they ought to ask themselves, why is it that every country has felt, has come across this need? It's like you try to be nice to them and then there's some sting, the scorpion sting is experienced, and the decision to expel them follows. And what is that awful thing they do? What is so bad? I mean, you can read the 1293 British Edict of Expulsion, and that was not the first, not the first national event. I think it started off about 300 AD in Alexandria, right? A tolerant multicultural city of Alexandria had to expel the Jews. And I found there's another one earlier than that, Rome, centuries BC, they expelled the Jews.
In Spain, right.
Yeah, Spain followed after England. Spain, France, so it happens in just about every country at one time or another. So instead of just making out that Germany's done something monstrous, I think one might see it in terms of a historical continuity. I don't think Germans should feel the guilt that they always seem to be experiencing for what they decided to do.
Right. And I think that the Jewish people need to say, well, gosh, they need to look at themselves and see, well, what is it that we're doing that we're not wanted anywhere? And
yeah, I mean, obviously they're wonderful, intelligent people, highly cultured, you know, all sorts of great musical conductors. I mean, they invented the days of the week, God, and the alphabet, you know. So they are clever. And Bagels, they're clever people. And their contribution to culture is not in doubt, you know. But there is this awful sting, and it's to do with, it seems to be to do with weaving stories that are not actually true.
Right. And certainly anti-Semitism is more abundant in the places that they live. And so there must be some sort of a thing that they're doing to have that much anti-Semitism. And there was actually people in the 1930s in this country that were very, very much in favor of what Hitler was doing. He was on the cover of Time magazine. And there was a lot of support for him early on. Henry Ford supported him, and a lot of other people. And then all of a sudden, you had the mafia in cahoots with some of the Jewish organizations here that were going after these people physically and throwing them out windows and all kinds of things. We are going to a break momentarily, and we've got about 7 more minutes after we come back from the break, or 4 more minutes, but we'll be right back.
Okay.
Welcome back. I just really cannot thank you enough for being on the program today. I know it's very late over there, and you're just such a trooper to stay with me for the entire 3 hours, and I just want you to know how much I appreciate you doing that, and how much I really appreciate your book, and the book is Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust Myth and Reality, and the website is whatreallyhappened.info. And you have sacrificed much in your search and your dissemination of the truth. You've paid a very high price for doing that. And so I applaud your courage, and I just think you're a terrific human being.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to someone as well informed and wise as yourself, Maria. And I must get to read some of the books on your website that look really important.
Well, I thank you. But I was also thinking during the break that, and it's also as a result of something in the chat room. Somebody said, when are we going to hear about what the communists did and how many people they deliberately slaughtered, such as in the Ukraine and in the gulags?
Yeah. Well, that was a real Holocaust, wasn't it?
Yes.
You know, how many tens of millions? Can you get a number even to the nearest 10 million?
Exactly.
I mean, that was a vast. I think Solzhenitsyn did try to write about this.
Yes.
And he has actually got a book about Jews in Russia, which is not allowed to be translated into English.
Right. 200 years altogether? Is that the one?
It might be. I don't know. But I've just been told that there's a book that cannot be translated into English.
Yeah. I think they've been doing it little by little, and it's on a website. He definitely suffered. A lot of people suffered. A lot of people died in the gulags, it's terrible.
Let's hope that our discussions of this can lead to some renovation, revival of the wonderful culture of Germany. It's the heart of Europe, and it was a great and glorious culture. I suggest it was the Christian center of Europe, let's hope that we're sort of trying to find out this historical truth that they're not allowed to access themselves, you know.
Yes.
Let's hope this can lead to some renovation of Germany.
Yes, and that is the saddest thing, that some people actually, some Germans actually believe in that same mythology, which is very sad. Very sad indeed. And they need to know the truth more than anyone.
They've got hordes of people. They're putting people in jail for thought crime in Germany. An enormous burning of books in Germany. Many countries in Europe, books are being burned. You know, this is a sign of book burning and thought crime imprisonment. And we want to put a stop to that, you know.
Absolutely.
We want to live in a world where people are free to find historical truth.
Indeed. And you've certainly contributed to that effort. So thank you very much for being on the program.
And, Look forward to another time then.
Okay, that would be lovely. Thank you so much. Now, get to bed.
Okay, yes.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Take care. Talk to you soon.